Good afternoon. Go ahead and be seated. All right. This is the date, place, and time.
Good work.
Except for the public meeting on 80KT 435 pertaining to the amendment of the foreclosure mediation rules. Before we get started, I want to set a couple little ground rules. First of all, I know there's a whole lot of people here. There's a whole lot of people in Carson City that would like to speak. So we are going to limit remarks to 2 minutes, unless you're otherwise directed by any of the members of the court. The next rule is that we are going to ask that you keep your comments relevant to the rules themselves, the proposed amendments. We would also ask that you do not come up and comment on any individual cases that are pending. At some point, we may have to review those cases, and so we don't want you to get into individual cases. The next rule is please try to avoid duplicating what the speakers have said before you. And I will also remind you that you are encouraged to provide written remarks, and we will accept those written remarks through this Friday, December, I believe, 10th. So with that, I would like to say this has been a tremendous effort. The court has put in a tremendous amount of time in helping this program develop. We've been tasked with that, and we've spent a tremendous amount of time. In particular, Justice Gibbons and his efforts. He's been tireless in his efforts, and we always anticipated that these rules would be a work in progress, and they need amendment as the program matures and as problems are demonstrated and issues come up during the course of this program's maturation. So these amendments are the latest that have been found to be necessary. These are proposals. Nothing has been adopted, and that's why we're having this public hearing, to vet these rules and try and get a feel for whether or not they should be adopted. So with that, Maurice, are you here? Where are you? There you are. If you would come up and give us a little statement, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Maurice Campbell, the Deputy Director of the Foreclosure Mediation Program. And I'm honored to be here to give a report not only to you but also to the public regarding the program. We recently received the honor of an invitation to the White House at the behest of the Vice President of the United States to provide some input on their task force regarding foreclosure mediation programs across the country. One of the things that was unique about our program is that we engaged a group of stakeholders that included lenders' representatives, homeowner representatives, homeowners' judges, and yourselves. So our program is unique, and it is being recognized across the country, and I'd just like to take an opportunity to share some of the highlights. Some of the program outcomes, we just completed our first year of operation. And out of 4,200 mediations completed, we had 89% of the cases that did not go to foreclosure. Out of that 89%, we had 61% where an agreement was reached. That agreement reached could include where the homeowner agreed to stay in the home or they agreed to vacate the home. 16% agreed to vacate the home, and 46% agreed to stay in the home. So the program is showing indications that it is working, and it is doing what the program was created to do, which was to address the foreclosure crisis here in Nevada and to also keep homeowners in their homes if possible. Nevada is the number one foreclosure mediation state, but it's also the number one foreclosure state in the country. We're also number one regarding unemployment. So it's not a problem that we're going to see go away. One of the other things that's great about our program is that the program can readily adapt. Changes can be readily made through the adaptation of the rules, which, as you hear the comments today, you'll hear comments from homeowners reps, lenders reps, and they were also involved in the suggestion of some of these rule changes. I want to just give a brief overview of what the trends look like here in Nevada. We averaged about 6,000 notices of default filed over the last year. In October, this past October, we saw that drop to about 4,900. So we do see notices of default going down. However, we see an increase in the participation in the program. So the elections into the program are actually increasing. Out of that increase, we estimate there are about 15% of total notices of default where the homeowners are electing in. But I must point out that that notice of default count includes not just owner-occupied property, but it also includes properties that are rentals or other properties that are not eligible for the program. It is estimated by economists that it's going to take Nevada about 5 years to come out of the foreclosure crisis. The program participation is actually increasing. I told you before where it was 15% overall, but now from when we started this program, we see a 38% increase of overall homeowner participation into the program from the last quarter of last year to the first quarter of this year, which actually would include August, September, and November of 2010. We're looking for the program participation to increase as we increase awareness. The program recently released grant funding in the amount of $300,000 total with six actual nonprofit organizations that took advantage of the grant process to help us get the word out regarding the program. Some of the groups that you'll be hearing from today will include the United Trustee Association. There may also be representatives here from Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. They represent homeowners. And also you may hear from some of the banks. I want to just reiterate that without the participation of these stakeholders providing their comment and our community working together as a whole, it would be very difficult to get this program up and running and to keep it going. And lastly, before I give you what our latest statistics are, I want to also recognize the administrative offices of the courts. When I met with the task force in Washington, D.C., I was asked how did the program get up off the ground so quickly, and I shared with them how the administrative offices of the courts provided the undergirding through their infrastructure of their information systems and their accounting system, as well as their other departments, to help get this program off the ground. And it is now something that's being considered as a model throughout our country. Finally, I'll share with you the results of our mediations for our first quarter. And that's actually July 1, 2010 through September 30th, 2010. 1,800 cases that came through the program in that time. Out of that 1,800, we had 436 where there were no agreement and no certificate was issued. But we also had over 1,300 where agreements were reached. Out of that 1,300, in our first quarter of our second year, we had 916 agreements where the homeowner agreed to stay in the home. We had 457 agreements where the homeowner agreed to vacate the home. These are just some preliminary statistics that I shared with you. The program is in the process of becoming fully automated. It is our hope that by this time next year, we'll be able to give you more in-depth statistics. So with that, if I have no questions, I will take my seat.
Any questions? All right. Thank you, Ms. Campbell.
Thank you.
Tracy, I have a question for you. Did we get a sign-up sheet with any people looking to speak? I'm inclined to take them in order that they signed in. Justice Gibbons, was there anything you would like to add to Mr. Campbell's?
Well, Chief, again, just to explain to everybody in the room here and then those of you in Carson City, we're going to discuss rule amendments today. The proposed rule amendments are just for consideration. They've been generated through a committee consisting of myself and members of the AOC staff, which is the Administrative Office of the Courts, the work in the Foreclosure Mediation Program. An order was signed on November 9, 2010 and sent filed publicly, whereby people are given the opportunity to file written responses or comments to these proposed rules through next Friday, which is December 10th. So you will have a chance today if you don't, because of the limited time, based on the number of people here wish to speak, if you want to make additional comments, you can do so and just file in and send them to the Supreme Court Clerk in Carson City. And I've already received a stack of comments and so have my colleagues on the court from various attorneys and all and other participants, which we've all read, and I might add it really has some excellent suggestions. And all of this is going to be taken into consideration before the court goes ahead and votes on these proposed changes in the rules. But today, again, we're going to focus on these rules themselves. I know, as the Chief said, we have, all of you may have some individual experiences you'd like to talk about, but primarily what we're here today to talk about is these rules and all like that. If you have specific comments on proposed rule amendments, then the court can address those comments. Thank you, Chief.
Okay. All right, let me go ahead and start with the list that's been presented to me. First name I have is that wishes to speak, Venetia Considine.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are three issues that three proposals that I would like to go over. The first of those would be the removal of the mediators, and that would be at rule number four. The intention for all of these suggestions is to make this program run smoothly, and the intention of the program is to assist homeowners in remaining in their homes. Along those lines, also, we really value competent mediators, especially mediators that are very familiar with the rules and want to continue being mediators. What we would like to suggest is a due process for removal of mediators to make this program a little bit more transparent. We have sent in some suggestions, and we will send in additional suggestions after this. But we suggest if the administrator temporarily stops assigning a mediator mediations, to have that within a time-barred area, about 60 days. And then within those 60 days, if the mediator so requests, to have a hearing held to determine whether the suspension is warranted. So that's the first issue that we wanted to bring up, is something where there's a due process for the mediators before they're removed.
So who would you propose that the hearing be held before?
Well, since the mediators serve at the pleasure of the court, it should be some judicial department. I mean, of course, we'd like the Supreme Court, but that might be a little bit too big. But something outside of the administration of the program that can make a determination as to whether or not a mediator, if a mediator is removed, if that is warranted. The second one I would like to discuss would be as far as rule number six, the petition for judicial review. As it is now, the petition covers the limited purposes of determining bad faith, enforcing agreements within the program, and temporary modifications or agreements. We would suggest that the petition for judicial review actually becomes a little bit wider to resolve all of the issues concerning the mediation. So it's not just specific to determinations of bad faith or enforcing agreements. And then our last suggestion would be for Rule 10.3, which also concerns the petition for judicial review. As suggested, or as it stands right now, if an agreement is made and the agreement is not followed through, the people that would be filing the petition have 15 days from the mediator's statement. What we're seeing is that when agreements aren't being followed through, it happens beyond the 15 days. In some of those instances, It is not just the agreement that is being followed through. It's some paperwork, or it's something a little bit beyond that. So we would like the discovery to be 15 days from the discovery of that agreement being breached or followed through.
All right. Thank you. And I'm going to also ask, when you do come up, if you could state your relationship with the program, if there is one, any of the speakers. So
I'm an attorney with the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, and I represent homeowners in the mediations.
All right. The next name I have is Michael Joe.
My name is Michael Joe, and I'm an attorney at the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, and I sit on the Rules Committee, as well as work very hard to try to make the mediation program work, and I do represent homeowners in the mediation as well. I guess I want to talk about a couple things. One is, and these are suggestions to make the process work, because I think that if the process was working, because we like the law, if the process worked, then we thought that we would have a really good law that's effective and make mediations work well in Nevada. The first thing I want to talk about is sanctions. Now, I know in AB 149, it specifically talks about sanctions. And I think that although there are sanctions in the program, the significant sanction is that a lender can't foreclose if they're found to be in bad faith. But I think that the spirit of the law maybe needs to be broadened a little bit. I would also point out that in AB 149, it also says that you're supposed to protect the program from abuse. And I recognize there are over 300 mediators. If you allow 300 mediators to recommend sanctions, you might get results that are all over the map, and maybe that wouldn't be in the best interest of the program. So I would suggest a limited set of sanctions. We already have a check-the-box type of approach for the mediator statement. Is maybe we should also have a check-the-box approach to sanctions as well. And what I had suggested, and it's in the comments I've made before, is maybe there are some different levels of sanctions, and maybe there's some monetary sanctions, maybe starting at as low as $1,000 and maybe $5,000, but also an ability for mediator to recommend sanctions in terms of what a loan modification maybe should be, in terms of what principal reduction should be, or maybe what forbearance would be maybe for someone who's unemployed. And we just think that that would be closer to what the bill says than what's happening now. The second suggestion we want to make is about the mediator statement in particular, because right now we have a check-the-box statement, but what we see is that homeowners and lenders are unsure as to what's going to happen after that mediator statement is completed. Because before it was pretty clear, because we had language that said that no further action is required, and that was commonly accepted to mean that no certificate would be issued. Now it's unclear when you walk out of mediation exactly what's going to happen, which makes it very difficult to file a petition for judicial review, which does happen in 15 days. I see my time has expired. Can I have a few minutes to...
Yes. Okay. I'm going to give you an additional minute.
Thank you very much. So what we think is that it should be obvious when they leave mediation. So the boxes probably should be that one, a certificate will issue, or two, a certificate will not issue, and there should be reasons for that. You can have the same boxes. It should say the lender did or did not bring the documents, or the homeowner did or did not bring the documents. But it should be clear, and if you have the mediator check the boxes. Because the process, the way it happens now, is after that mediator statement is completed, it comes back to the program office, and each of those statements is being reviewed by the program office. In order to make this process more effective and efficient, you would think that the mediator, who really should be deciding this, should decide when you walk out and decide it then. And I think it would just make the process be a lot more efficient.
Okay, any questions? Thank you. All right, the next name I've got with a indication of maybe they wish to speak is Pat McKnight.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Pat McKnight. I'm a licensed attorney. I'm also a mediator in the foreclosure mediation program. I've done it since its inception. I've done probably about 150 to 200 mediations. I put down maybe on there because I was hoping other people were going to speak the comments for me. I'd like to just talk about the proposed Rule 4, subparagraph 2, regarding the possible disqualification of mediators. In the case that they represent homeowners or banks also in other mediations. The thing I've learned in the number of mediations I've done so far is that experience representation is key. It helps the process so much better than inexperience. And because this foreclosure mediation and loan modifications is such a new area, you just won't have a lot of experience out there. I'm sorry to say this, I'll probably be stoned by my colleagues, but some of the worst representatives I have had appear before me as a mediator have been inexperienced attorneys. The best, and that's not to say to all of them, some of them know their business, but by and large, the attorneys who come in who have no experience harm the process and slow it down. But some of the best attorneys I've had representing on either the bank side or on the homeowner side have been those who have had tremendous amount of experience, and by crash course, the mediators have been the ones with the most experience. So those mediators who then come back and represent these homeowners or the banks, the process is much smoother on both sides of the fence. The homeowners oftentimes don't know, I'd say oftentimes never know, when they come in what their rights are, what the consequences of reaching an agreement are, or what they aren't. And if you get somebody in there who understands that process, it's truly important. And I don't really see the conflict. I've been practicing in these courts for 20 years. I am an arbitrator under the mandatory arbitration program. I also use that mandatory arbitration program myself on behalf of my clients. And as you know, those arbitrators almost exclusively either represent insurance companies on the one hand or plaintiffs on the other hand. And they make excellent arbitrators because of their experience. They know their business. So here's a case where I don't think it is detrimental to allow it. I actually believe it's beneficial. Thank you.
Of the number of mediations you've had, has any party said to you, geez, I don't want you to serve as the mediator because you represent another party?
That's never been said to me. In all honesty, I probably only represented maybe 3 or 4 people in mediation. It's not a big part of my practice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I've got an indication from Kurt Harris that perhaps you would like to speak. Are you here and do you want to speak?
Your Honors, Mr. McKnight just summed up everything I had to say, I guess, on that proposed rule change. My name is Kurt Harris. I'm a sole practitioner, and I represent homeowners as well as I'm proud to be a mediator in the program. I don't feel like it develops that professional relationship that's stated there in the rule, and I would request that and not be implemented, that portion of it. It would affect a significant portion of my practice, and I don't know if I'm the only one here that it would, but I don't feel that it causes me to have a conflict of interest to represent a homeowner and or be a mediator at any time.
In any of your mediations, has a lender or their counsel objected to your conducting the mediation?
No one has ever indicated any objection to it. It's come up on occasion, but no one's ever indicated that there was any impropriety and no objections have been made.
When it came up, what was said or what was the concern?
Oh, just in no concern, just conversation that I was also a mediator and was here in a representative capacity, just discussing the rules in the program.
Okay.
Outside of the mediation.
Chief, could I suggest that we see a show of hands as to how many people would agree with the last two speakers that really there's no conflict here, and I'd like to see the number of people who agree with them as opposed to the people who feel there is a conflict and it shouldn't be that way, if it's okay with you, Chief.
Sure.
Could I see how many people are in favor of what the last two speakers said about how many people would oppose that and feel that the rule should be changed? Well, that was a waste.
Let's see if I curse and see
it. That's it. I'll be quiet.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, though, for
continuing.
It was close.
Well, I'll just, because it's a close question, apparently, for myself, I'll simply indicate that for those who believe we should adopt the rule, I'm interested in hearing specific examples of where the mediator's representation of apparently the opposite side from you is a real problem in accomplishing a fair mediation. Is there anybody over there that would like to speak on that issue, on the flip side of this? Yes, sir, would you come up?
Hi. Is that his name?
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Aaron Waite. I'm an attorney with the Cooper Castle Law Firm, and we represent lenders and servicers. Let me state before I go on that I'm not taking a position on behalf of any lenders in saying this. We've seen it. We have raised objections when this has come up in the past, but the concern is that mediators are privy to the evaluative methodology and other potentially internal proprietary procedures to the lenders when they act as mediators, but then when they're acting as borrower's counsel or plaintiff's counsel, if it's on judicial review, they're privy to information that could be used against a lender. So the times when we've raised the concern is when we have a mediation opposite an attorney who's representing a borrower, and then later have a mediation with that same attorney who's acting as a mediator, and we're representing the same lender. So that's primarily where we've seen it come up, but it hasn't been, in my experience, more than two or three times that I've raised the objection. I can't speak for all the other attorneys in my office.
Are you finding that any of that confidential information is, in fact, being used?
No. Simply a concern.
Would you have some secret formula you don't want people to know about? I mean, that seems counterproductive to the program. I mean, I presume that the lenders would use a similar, your lenders or your clients would use a similar approach from mediation to mediation. Might adjust depending upon who the borrower is, but what difference does it make if a mediator here's that formula in a particular mediation and then shows up in a they could just as easily hear about it if they're on the opposite end of the case.
That may be true, Your Honor, but if it's a confidential evaluative methodology, and they're not always, but there may be times when there's information in that evaluative methodology or in a confidential settlement proposal that's specific to the lender that the lender does not, that the borrower may not see or borrower's counsel may not see.
Such as
Specific programs that may be available besides HAMP or besides HAFA, such as programs that aren't government specific or ways that loans are evaluated if they're not subject to being approved under HAMP or HAFA or another government program.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thanks. Any other folks on the flip side?
Chief, could I make a comment on this particular rule here? Again, for everybody's benefit, when the initial Rules Committee drafted the rules on this particular issue, again, the committee consisted of myself on representing the Supreme Court and representatives of lenders, borrowers, and title companies. So we had a mix of everybody involved in drafting the initial set of rules. We thought about putting this restriction in the initial set of rules. We didn't because of exactly what Mr. McKnight said, is that arbitrators in the Nevada Nevada Mandatory Arbitration Program sometimes represents insurance companies or plaintiffs and act also as arbitrators, and also in the short jury trial program, the same thing. So we felt that in the court system, that's the way it's done, and it's worked successfully for many years. So we didn't put that in. The reason it's up for discussion now is we've received some complaints about potential conflicts and all, and that's what I think Justice Hardesty and Justice Sada and all we're trying to get to, the specifics here, because we don't know the specifics and all for the people that have concerns about that, so we'd like to hear about that to make as part of our evaluation. Thank you.
If I may just address this really quickly, and Michael Brooks from Brooks Gallagher. We represent lenders almost exclusively, and I do have an attorney in my office who does do mediations. But the concern for us is not so much the potential conduct, whereas you have a mediator who maybe represents borrowers on a regular basis, and we're there and we understand where they're coming from. That's not the problem. The problem is the actual conflict, where they have represented a borrower against one of my lender clients, and they have been privy as a mediator. It's privy to confidential information about how the mediation is to be treated, or excuse me, the loan
evaluated methodology for a particular loan for a particular borrower may not be under the same parameters for a different borrower in a different mediation, yet they'll have access to information that may be favorable to their client or that they may try to use against my client, and in front of that mediator make my client look like they're acting in bad faith when there's a strict limitation on the types of proposals that are available for that borrower. It's the actual conflict. It's those situations where the mediator represented a borrower against, I'll use a lender's name in particular, Bank of America, who happens to be one of the larger, we don't represent them, Bank of America. They come in as a mediator, they're representing Bank of America. They receive the confidential proposal. They turn around, and we have had this happen, where a mediator represented in later that afternoon, we were representing a lender. They were the mediator, received confidential information. That afternoon, the same attorney came into our office on behalf of a borrower representing a borrower against our lender. Having received that confidential information about how loan proposals are done in one instance, again, in front of that mediator, that same confidential proposal may be used to make our clients look like they're acting in bad faith for not making the same exact offer to their client. In that
you say may be used. Is it actually being used?
It has been. And I have counsel from my office who can address that specific instance if you like, Your Honor. That would be McCarran Moran hooking off of that.
Yeah, we're not going to get into this.
Understood. But that's the issue, and it's not a potential. What we're talking about are actual conflicts, where they're acting as a mediator in a case for involving a lender, and then they're adverse party to that lender in a subsequent case. We're not talking about potential. Where an industry, by the way, that's the other thing. The language of the rule change is somewhat ambiguous. It makes it appear that you have to choose sides, either a borrower or a lender, or if you choose sides as a borrower or lender's counsel, you are disqualified from being a mediator, which presents the problem that the first speaker spoke of, and I forgot his name, but presents the problem that you're eliminating a large number of qualified mediators from the pool of potential mediators. If you've just chosen a side, I'm okay with those people as long as they choose to remain neutral and we know where they're coming from in that mediation. But if they have access to information with regard to my particular lender and the way they do business, then that becomes an actual conflict and a problem. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
I'm Phil Hoffman. I'm a mediator. Just to speak on behalf of between both lenders and homeowners, with respect to the specifics, if there's one mediation that comes to a conclusion and the homeowner or the bank offers a particular deal, it's based on that specific circumstance. What will tend to happen is if you get a mediator who's representing most of the time homeowners, they might use that particular specific example of a particular solution to try to get, you know, to say if the bank doesn't give that particular solution, then they would be in bad faith. So,
well, wouldn't that be an inappropriate use of confidential information?
Absolutely, and it does.
And wouldn't that be shouldn't that be a basis to remove the mediator from the roles of the FMP?
Yeah, I guess it should, but the reality is that I'm telling you specific instances of occurrences that do happen. So I'm not necessarily saying that I've turned them into the program, et cetera, et cetera. What I am saying is that on a balanced basis, if you have a mediator that's not representing either homeowners or lenders, you're going to get a more objective decision, not decision, potential agreement. That's where I see it.
Got somebody back there?
All right.
Thank you. I appreciate letting me speak. My name is Dean Gould. I'm an attorney. I'm also a mediator. I've handled probably over 150 mediations. I did write comments. I just want to comment on two things on what I heard. First of all, this rule, if passed, as revised, proposed, will have a significant, in my opinion, negative effect on the mediators who are probably qualified people. In my case, I've only represented one person as a borrower, so I have no vested interest in this, but I will tell you that the mediators who come in front of me as a mediator are the best prepared, but from both sides. Secondly, with all due respect to Mr. Brooks, and I'm not saying this to him personally, when we get these confidential qualitative methodologies, I'm telling you, it's boilerplate language that everyone sends exactly the same thing. It says very much, very little information. And the information that comes out in the mediation about what they're willing to do or not comes through the representative, whether they're on the phone or in the room. And it's specific to that mediation. I'd also just in closing point out that, as you've indicated, the Code of Judicial Conduct applies to us. So if I'm in a situation where I happen to have represented someone, I'm duty-bound to say I cannot handle this. And if I do, then I think the removal mechanism should take place. Thank you.
Thank you. What about the training? You told me about training. You've done some training of mediators.
I've done training of mediators where people who have represented lenders, for example, just went through some significant training, and now they're going to be told they can't mediate. Seems somewhat inappropriate to me since they've spent all the time training.
How many were in your training session?
Well, I didn't count them, but I knew when I trained them, and I know through I do the co-mediation training when they come in, and I help them do their training, I bet you I saw five or six people just in eyesight that had been in front of me as lender representatives. I would have no problem with those people being mediators.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Derek Graham Holm. I represent just homeowners. I'm not a mediator. On specifics with this conflict, it's the appearance of impropriety that's the problem. It's not that there's actual impropriety. There's not the fact that they're making decisions based on confidential information, which I don't know why it'd be confidential. Why don't we just put it on the table for the homeowner and say, this is what you got to meet? So if we're going to eliminate, let's get rid of the confidential information. I think we owe it to both the homeowners and the banks to have a mediator that has no potential conflict. Because this program is set up on behalf of the homeowners, but it's also on behalf of the banks. And I'm somewhat speaking against my own position, but we can't forget that the banks are here trying to modify loans, and to have any improprieties or positions of impropriety does affect the system as a whole. Because these out-of-state banks are being brought to Nevada for this special program, as you know, it's unique. And if we have mediators functioning as homeowner representatives, it could be the seed of our destruction with this program. And I think, yes, we'll lose some mediators, but the program's not just starting when you did it, when we needed as many mediators as we could get. The program is now underway. I think we have 300 mediators, and we'll get more. They're not going to disappear, and I think we'll get quality people. And this isn't brain surgery. Once you learn the system and learn the rules, you can do it as a competent attorney. I can tell you that from personal experience. And I think I'd rather have you err, since they fall under the canons of judicial procedure, to err on the side of not having any appearance of impropriety.
Why is it different than the court-annexed arbitration or the short trials, where somebody may be a plaintiff's attorney or somebody may be an insurance attorney, and yet they can be very popular? I know I was popular as an arbitrator, and I represented plaintiffs, and Jim Armstrong, who represented insurance companies, was very popular when the court annex program started in prehistoric times when I was a lawyer.
Well, I believe in most cases there are a lot of home cooking. That's a lot of Las Vegas issues that have legal, really stringent rules that we operate under. This mediation is somewhat subjective. I would say it's very subjective. And I'll speak on that later when I come back. But it's more subjective. The mediators get to choose what's bad faith or what's not bad faith. And you end up with this question of, was it what we said, or is it what we did, or is it the rules that say you have to check me for bad faith for not bringing documents? But I'll address some other issues in the future.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. John Boyer. I'm an attorney, I'm a mediator, and I'm an arbitrator, and I'm a short trial judge. And I noticed, Judge Sherry, you were thinking along the lines about the issue of why should arbitrators and mediators and short trial judges be any different than mediators? And I think the point that has to be made is that when you're selected as an arbitrator or as a short trial judge, the people are given a list of people that are randomly selected, and then you can remove some people that you feel don't think are qualified, or maybe you do have an existing conflict with. But the mediators are just totally picked at random, And you don't know, you know, up until the point where the case is actually assigned to the mediator, nobody knows who the mediator is, and they may actually have some issues with them, but then they're stuck with them unless the mediator recognizes the conflict and recuses himself. And I don't know that that's going to happen all the time. And I'll say that I was with a nonprofit group, the Senior Citizens Law Project, and I actually quit that position because they were starting to represent people that were homeowners in these mediations, and I wouldn't do it. I couldn't even be associated with it, so I just quit. So last week was my last week, so I saw that the appearance was there, and I didn't want to get involved in it. Thank you.
Let me ask you a question. Does the fact that this is so subject-specific, we had mentioned arbitrations and short trials, where you may sit on a number of different subject areas, here's a very, very specific subject area, and you may have a mediator who also has a practice primarily made up of representing either homeowners or lenders.
Well, I think the very fact that it's so specific actually it makes the problem worse because it's such a small number of people that are doing it. And I don't think the fact that the mediators are extremely qualified to represent homeowners can trump the issue over the appearance of bias. And I just don't want to even go there. And I agree with the last speaker that, you know, you would put things in jeopardy if you had some people that felt like, well, you know, the mediator crosses over from side to side all the time, and you just don't know which way their bias might be, but you're stuck with them for that mediation. There's no second chances.
I think what you're suggesting is the court consider, in lieu of this, the disqualification process, a strike process like we have in ADR, or...
Well, first of all, I think the homeowners are a little disadvantaged. They don't know the mediators. Obviously, the bank's attorneys know who the mediators are and who those mediators actually would participate as representatives of homeowners. So I think then, I don't think you're going to have informed decisions made by homeowners, and that would be a problem. And then it may just slow up this whole process of assignments anyway. And then you're going to have administrative problems where, well, somebody got five cases as a mediator and one person objected to them, and then now you have to reassign another case to that mediator to make up for the five cases.
Thank you. Let me take just a couple more on this subject. We'd like to kind of vet some of the other rules. We've been kind of stuck on one particular rule here. So we'll take two more on this subject.
Benjamin Child, I'm a local attorney and a mediator. I did file written comments, and I just... The mediator really shouldn't be making any decisions. And if the mediator does actually make a bad faith finding, it better be backed up. So I don't think there's a whole lot of risk with the mediator also representing people, either lender or homeowner. And again, there's a huge amount of experience that's going to be lost. I don't know what the numbers are, and I commented on that. I don't know how many lawyers would be kicked out because of this rule, but I'm thinking that it's the more experienced ones.
Do you also do homeowner or lender representations in your practice?
Homeowner. But I don't think it biases anything, because the only thing the mediator is supposed to be finding is, did they bring all the documents? Were the documents exchanged? And if there's a bad faith finding, it should be backed up. And almost, I don't know what the percentage is, but if there is a bad faith finding, it's almost always PJR. And then Judge Mosley reviews it down here anyway. So the mediator isn't like making decisions like in an arbitration context. I think it's a totally different animal. Mediator's just kind of monitoring and moving forward.
Thank you. And one more.
Good afternoon. My name is Ren Johnson. I am the standing president of an organization called the United Trustees Association. Through our partnership with Nevada Mediation, myself, you brought Freddie Mac as part of your training partner for your mediators. I'm just going to address as a trustee as just one portion, because I have sat through meetings, I've observed them, I've been on them, I've been on the phone calls, and I work daily with lenders in your process. As Ray said, this is a partnership. The partnership is just not for the benefit of the homeowner, it's for the benefit of the lending community. And what we do now through this program is going to affect this state and its recovery in the future. In general, we support the additional requirements with regards to mediators. In all honesty, Your Honors, we're just going to make it fair. We're going to make it a fair process, both for the lender and for the homeowner. If there's a situation that arises, whether it's either a private confidential memo or anything else, we feel that there's certain things that people can't be judges and juries. In other words, they can't be on both sides. One gentleman said prior to me stepping up to this podium that we're not given the option ahead of time. We don't know who our mediators are. If there are some situations that we can come up and we can ask a mediator to be disqualified, that might make some of the process a little bit easier and better. Our main item, Mr. Honor, is just we want to make this fair process, unbiased. One gentleman, one mediator said prior, we want to start putting sanctions in, we want to start, it's basically more of a punishment. That's not going to help your process. What your process is, what's going to help is keeping the partnership together and having all parties work together. I can tell you right now, Verese has worked closely with the lending community. She's probably one of the few state officials I've ever worked with that has been open-armed with regarding a partnership. From the first day I met her, we invited her to a dinner meeting. She came in, and after the dinner meeting, she says, I need your help. She came to us, and I have a lot of respect for her for that.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Justice, we have at least one person in Carson City who wants to address this.
All right. Okay, let's go to Carson City.
I'm a mediator and I'm an attorney, and I've been practicing in the consumer finance area since 1980. I think the rule you have here is overbroad. People should be able to decide if they have confidential information or if they're biased. You're creating an irrebuttable presumption that any mediator that's ever represented a homeowner is biased or has confidential information. I will tell you that isn't true. There are lots of people who can do that. And so I'm thinking you might want to toughen, you might want to get more specific about rather than just create a rebuttable assumption that if a guy's ever represented a homeowner, he must be. The other thing I'd like to address is this allegation that mediators have confidential information. The rule does require the banks to give us a statement of the evaluative methodology they use. A legal boilerplate. Every single mediation I have with the same attorney, I get the same statement. All they do is change the names. So, they're not really giving us anything specific to anything. They're simply complying with the rule with legal boilerplate. Two, I will tell you, having represented more than 10,000 debtors in bankruptcy over a 30-year career, and many of them dealing with mortgages, that you can easily figure out the bank's guidelines to its employees after you've done about a half dozen of these, because they're talking about what they can and can't do in the mediation. And so when you say just because they have to give you a statement that you've got to keep confidential when you're a mediator, I will tell you the information in there is not confidential. It's not a trade secret if you started looking at it. Just boilerplate. So I'm suggesting that you perhaps make it more specific as to why you would want us to recuse ourselves if we're, but rather than creating this irrebuttable presumption.
Thank you. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to other aspects of the rule. And I've still got a few more names here. If you were desiring to speak on this particular issue that we just covered and nothing else, just indicate that to me. Philip Hoffman.
He spoke already.
Let's see, you already speak? Yep. Did you have something else on another aspect of the rule? Okay.
Basically, two or three issues. The first is there's no provision in these rules for who pays their costs of appearing at mediations. My issue with that is I don't know if we have to just talk about these specific proposed changes.
That's what we'd like to confine this to, is these particular proposed rules on Exhibit A.
Okay, very good. Under Rule 2.3c, I agree with the former that there should be more of a good cause. If you're going to suspend a mediator for good cause, there needs to be a due process of some kind. With respect to Rule 16.2,
why is that, Mr. Hoffman?
Because
the settlement conference judges of the court serve at the pleasure of the court. Why should we approach mediators differently? You swear an oath to be a mediator. It is a privilege to serve. It is not a license. There is a vast legal difference between license and privilege. What makes it necessary for the court to adopt some due process arrangement for the involvement of suspension, or for that matter, the removal of mediators at the behest of the court and at their at-will determination?
Well, the definition of good cause is not really clear. I mean, I think there needs to be some understanding from a mediator's point of view as to what the parameters of that might be. So is that an arbitrary decision by the administrator? I mean, there might be circumstances where you get complaints as a mediator by either party, not necessarily justified. So does that mean that if you've got a complaint that you get, you know, the administrator strikes you, or the reason that those complaints might not be justified is most likely that the outcome did not turn out the way either the homeowner or lender wanted. So you might get those arbitrary complaints. And therefore, it needs to be spelled out a little bit more clearly as to what good cause means. Now, to actually institute a whole due process that may be beyond the scope or ability, practically speaking.
Thank you. Let's see, Aaron Waite, did you have anything else on any other aspect of the rule?
I do. We'll submit it in writing.
Okay, thank you. All right, I can't quite read the writing here. Michael Finnick, Management for CJSIC.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Mike Finucci. I'm a forensic auditor of mortgage and securitization documents. And what we do is we go and investigate all of the documents that are required by AB 149 and determine the veracity of any of the documents submitted during the AB 149 mediation or any of the documents that have been recorded with the Clark County Assessor's Office. We noticed that in the mediations that we have examined for different various parties, that the document issue is never really discussed or gone over. The documents that are presented by the banks and the trustees are never actually examined properly, and thus you have lots of problems that actually the mediator doesn't recognize that exist in the documents. And since we believe that the documents as well as the financial ones are important to giving the homeowner a fair opportunity to a mediation with the people that they have signed an obligation with, we notice that there hasn't been any additions to the requirements for examining those documents, and we are very concerned about that. issue. And that would be under Rule 2, Part 2, Rule 5, and then Part 3, Rule 8. We noticed also that there's ample coverage of the financial positions for the homeowners and the financial negotiations for the homeowners, but we noticed that nobody is discussing any of the documents and the requisite AB 149 requirements for those documents, such as the original copy of the deed of trust, the mortgage note, each assignment of the deed of trust and the mortgage note, and a certified copy thereof. We've noticed that that's never been discussed, and we noticed that there isn't a lot of concern about that. There appears not to be, even though the language in AB 149 is quite sufficient. We're not sure why that is. And we'd like to see more things being done with respect to document examination. The homeowner can go in and do any negotiation, any financial position that they choose, and if they're negotiating with the wrong person, they are not going to get a fair result, and they end up being debt slaves for 30 or 40 years, whatever the extension of the program or the financial program is.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Stephen Cervantes, here? No? All right. Okay, that's all the signed up individuals that I have. Are there any other individuals here in Las Vegas that would like to speak on the various aspects of these proposed amendments? Yes. Next.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Again, my name is Rand Johnson. I'm with the United Trustees Association. I wanted to go through and speak as to rule number 7. Rule number 7 with regard to recording rescissions. In general, lenders just normally don't record rescissions of notices of default or to avoid mediation. The majority of the time it's done to go through and take an item off record or to remove a foreclosure action which needed, there could have been an error, there could have been something filed that constituted us to stop the foreclosure action. In addition, as to a comment with regards to documents, and I've looked at this and we've discussed this with the mediators and with the director, I feel that utilizing more web-based technology would solve a good majority of the situations and some of the complaints associated with this program. But utilizing and using some of the budget in order to develop a vibrant web system to follow up on certificates, follow up on status, and in addition to providing documents to your program, using the mail system, mailing documents in, establishing accounts where we can pay online instead of being worried about a check being lost in the mail. What happens, you'd like to go through, and your program is to be a vibrant program, you need to go through and embrace the technology that's out there. There's technology out there right now where we can upload our documents. Lenders and servicers are not fighting you. What happens is we want to work with you. The technology that we utilize as a foreclosure trustee and in the default field, we're completely online. Most of our foreclosures are paperless. In other words, we review documents online, we upload them online. Utilizing a paper document and utilizing writing checks is cumbersome for homeowners, it's cumbersome for lenders or trustees, and it slows down the process. We'd like to go through and see if we have a little bit less complaints about your program by modernizing it and by utilizing the web and utilizing the technology that's available.
There seems to be an issue, though, nationally as to the paper. And I'm not sure web-based technology will deal with that underlying concern.
Well, what happens is there's a gentleman prior to us, and my love for people that do forensic foreclosure work is something that
I'm not speaking as his, but
as you watch the news, and we've just come through a moratorium period with certain financial institutions going through because there was a question about their documents. Going web-based does not give you the ability to check that, and that's one of the underlying concerns that's outside of our program that other people are pursuing in the legal arena, true legal arena. But how does that address that concern as to the documents?
That's a very good question. Almost every lender that I work with, their documents are imaged. Now, granted, there are some situations where we've had words like robo signing, assignments, and those are issues which are not really part of this discussion. I understand that, but what happens? A good majority, most of the documents that we need, are already in our client system. To have them sent to us electronically, to have us print those documents up, package those documents together, obtain a check, obtain funds, and send them into...
Let's keep the financial aspect. That's easy enough to deal with. I'm talking about the documentation because that seems to be...
The documentations are there. They're available to us electronically. We can go through and bring them in and forward them on over and upload them up to a system. In other words, and a check-off-the-box system, for example. You need the deed of trust? Here's the deed of trust. We need assignments. Here are assignments that we have available. If any of the other documents that are required by the mediator, they could request them right through a web-based system. We're just trying to... I'm making the suggestion in order to make the system easier. That's all, Your Honor.
I'm trying to understand your concern about Rule 7. That rule doesn't invoke unless the lender records the rescission. So what's the problem? If the lender doesn't record the rescission, it doesn't seem to be an issue. The predicate sentence, the first sentence, says if the borrower requests mediation and somebody wants to stop it, the lender files a rescission. What's the problem with the rule?
The lender must obtain the written agreement of the grantor or person who holds title of record to stop mediation from proceeding.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with that? I thought your comment earlier was lenders don't record rescissions, so don't make us record rescissions.
No, they don't record rescissions just to stop mediation. There was conversations in... We've heard conversations out there where some lenders are just recording the rescission just to stop the mediation and have it go back and start the foreclosure again.
But this rule says that if someone asks for mediation and the trustee presents a rescission notice, then there needs to be a written agreement. Why doesn't that, to stop the mediation? What's wrong with that rule?
Because the foreclosure stops the default. Right now, we shouldn't have to obtain written permission from a homeowner if there's no default on the tenant.
Well, this is only if they've requested mediation. I mean, the concern is that the notice of default's recorded, the homeowner requests mediation, maybe the lender doesn't have documents, who knows what the reason is. The lender rescinds the notice of default, and the homeowner is kind of left hanging there. They've sent in their $200 and all that. I mean, that's what the genesis was of this rule. And again, I don't see a problem with that. I mean, this avoids game playing here, and that was the purpose of the rule.
I can understand that, but right now we're just afraid of some abuse on both sides. What happens is normally if in any non-judicial state, and I represent 10 non-judicial states, and includes California and the entire western area. We don't need the permission of a homeowner to basically stop. What happens is the recording of the notice of default should be more unilateral, that we're not going to go through mediation. We've stopped all default action. And that should be it right there. That's my opinion.
Okay. Well, the only reason that would even kick in is if they request mediation. If they don't, you can send us a default at any time. And if they have, maybe you don't like the mediator. Maybe it's a way to get rid of that mediator, and then you rescind it, then you re-record it and get a new mediator or something like that. I mean, these are the types of things potentially could happen.
I understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Joan Schiller Travis. I'm an attorney licensed in Illinois and Wisconsin, still in good standing. I moved here 2002. I'm not taking the bar, nor do I intend to. However, I am trained in mediation. I've taken the National Justice Center's mediation, which is a 40-hour program, as well as the foreclosure mediation program. And I can tell you, honestly, I've sat as an arbitrator in Illinois, and I've done these, and I think mediation is a lot harder. One of the reasons, of course, is that you're telling a lawyer to be quiet. I'm discussing mediation procedures, Rule 8. From the reading that I see from paragraph 1, it says, in addition to the documents set forth in Rule 5, the parties shall provide to the mediator and exchange such documents with the other party using the most expeditious method available. And that's where I'd like to stop, at least 10 days, etc. Most expeditious means available today appears to be email rather than sending hard copies. I know this because every time I talk to a lender or a beneficiary's representative or somebody on the other side or even the homeowners, can you email it to me? And according to what I was told, we can, but we also still have to send hard copies to everybody every time. At the end of the, so that means that I sent out 20, I had one, rather, excuse me, five mediations the other day that I booked and went to the post office and sent out, for five mediations, I sent out 20 envelopes. And that includes, you know, all these things that were necessary in there. For 20 papers that I, or 20 cases, when you go through the, at the end, when you have a mediator statement, you send again to the very same people that you would have sent to the beginning, starting ones. You send them the mediator statement. That's another bunch of papers. After that, you then send other papers, our statements and our other final things to our mediation program. That costs $200 for 20 people. And that the $200 is figured with my stationery, my printer, my ink, my stamps, and other materials, letters, you know, paper and envelopes, etc. However, that's not the biggest issue. Yes, it's $200 for 20 things. The biggest issue is, though, when I call them and say, I still have to send it anyway, they say, but we don't want it. And I say, but you're going to have to get it. My concern or my question is, if you mean most expeditious, can that be then particularized to say email or any such or any other, and you can list any other of the methods you prefer when you're choosing this? Most of the people are online, and most of the people don't want to handle paper anymore. And Nevada also prides itself on being green, and we've been discussing that for a long time in this community, going green. This is a good way to show that we mean it. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions?
Any questions? All right, thank you. All right.
Madam Justices, gentlemen Justices, Madam Supreme Court Clerk, I handed her an outline, and I just want to go over the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act.
Would you introduce yourself for the purpose of the records, please?
I apologize. On the last page of that, my credentials are I'm a licensed real estate agent. I'm a former mortgage banker broker since 1995.
What's your name again?
Michael Parra.
Okay.
And I'm a former appraiser.
Go ahead.
The Emergency Economic Stabilization Act purpose is to restore liquidity and stability to the financial and to ensure authority and facilities are used in a proper manner that protects home values, college funds, etc. My focus is on liquidity and stability in the financial system. As a licensed real estate agent, we have 90 hours of pre-licensing education, including not limited to agency, finance, appraisal, and 15 hours of Nevada and real estate property law. Further, each and every 2 years thereafter, the licensee is required to complete 24 hours of continuing education, which includes a minimum of 3 hours of real estate law, 3 hours of agency.
Mr. Carr, do you have something specific as to the rules?
Yes, I'm trying to establish my credibility.
You have 3 minutes, so your time is running. That's why I'm trying to direct you to the rules.
My purpose is to amend foreclosure mediation rule 1 to bring the buyer and lender together and increase the foreclosure mediation process and efficiency, amend participation in foreclosure mediation rule 8 to include a real estate licensee while acting under the authority of the license who has entered into a brokerage agreement to represent a client in a real estate transaction to short sale the home where a loan modification may supersede. The justification is we are acting within the authority of our license, and the effect is no notice of default is reported, a foreclosure is avoided, the inventory is reduced, and home prices stabilize. I have 100% success rate in liaisoning prior to it ever coming to mediation. And I think that's the purpose, to avoid a notice of default and avoid a foreclosure altogether. I have successfully negotiated either a short sale or a loan modification. Case in point, if you get a pre-approved short sale, the property sells quicker, it obtains multiple offers, and it sells for a higher price, and the notice of default is a moot point, and the foreclosure is a moot point. Secondly, I'd like to amend NRS 107.86. I hear everybody talking about paperwork document. I'm very immersed in this. There's a 25-year foreclosure in the package that I gave you because they can't secure the documents. When a servicer, bank, or private investor act in bad faith or are non-compliant with, not limited to, NRS, United States Code, Code of Federal Regulation, Uniform Commercial Code, and they are non-compliant with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or HUD underwriting guidelines, the mediator shall prepare and submit to the mediation administrator a petition and recommend imposing the following sanctions against the beneficiary. And this makes perfect sense if you allow me to speak. Sanction the beneficiary that acted in bad faith and or is non-compliant above until good faith is evidenced. The beneficiary shall defer the underwater amount of the principal balance on the back end of the remaining principal balance, otherwise known as the mark-to-market value, at 0% interest.
And again, what particular rule is this pertaining to? It's not like we're getting off track here again.
It's rule one.
And what particular proposed amendment to that rule that we're examining? You got to help us out here a little bit. We're looking very specifically at the amendments that are being proposed to the rules as they are. We're talking only about the proposed amendments here.
Yes, Exhibit A, Rule 1.
And which part of that rule is being proposed to be amended?
Number one, authority and scope purposes is to create rules for efficient administration of justice.
Justice Gibbons, is there a proposed amendment to that particular section?
No.
Okay. We're talking just about the amendments to the rules that we've got right now that are being proposed.
For the record, it appears as if Mr. Perry has submitted a rather in-depth written document that you certainly could consider. It seems that that might be the most expeditious manner for us to proceed.
And then to proceed specifically with the amended Exhibit A, 1, Scope of Rules, Rule 3, Presiding Mediator, Number 4, Mediator Qualifications.
Where are you?
Exhibit A, 1, Scope of Rules, Rule 3. Presiding Mediator, Number 4, Mediator Qualifications.
I don't see any proposed amendments to that particular provision either.
No. Chief, again, as Justice Sadis said, Mr. Perez submitted written comments, which we will consider each and all the written comments, but I think you gave the time limits so we get a chance to hear from everybody in Carson City and Las Vegas who would like to speak about specific rule amendments.
Right. And Mr. Perez will review the material which you presented to us.
and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else specific on the amended portions of this? Mr. Ravenholt?
I'm going to be specific and just tell you my proposals are because of the experiences I've had during many mediations so far. And we'll first go through the page 3, which is rule 5C, 54C, which talks about the trust issue and the property being held in a trust. Does that, when the property is held in trust, does that avoid the homeowner, residence, owner-occupied portion of this?
I think, Mr. Ravenholt, we're talking about a revocable trust, which many people have, that they have titled their homes, and an irrevocable trust would be a different situation.
Okay, also, you know, children can be living in the home, and it's the default is set to the trust holder. I'm just trying to clarify, since we're doing some changes, that this is addressed and at least brought up before we do the changes. We also have rule on page 6. We're going to be on rule.
But before you leap away from that, then what your concern is that that when considering trusts, there is a connection between the trustor and the owner occupancy.
That's correct, and it's been left out in my reading, but I might be wrong. But I think that would be a loophole that could create problems. Since we're changing the rule, let's address it or at least acknowledge it.
Mm-hmm. And so let's not leave it hanging. Should the change require that in these circumstances the trustor is the owner occupant?
I would think that clarification would solve all the problems. Since we have a different owner now, and we're identifying a unique owner.
Well, I think that's a very good point you make there.
We're on 8, 9, C, and D, where we give the power of attorney, the eligible participant has the power of attorney. Does that void the homeowner being present at the hearing? It's void of any language that the homeowner still has to be present. If I get the power of attorney as the attorney for the homeowner, does the homeowner still have to be present?
Well, I don't think we've said anywhere a homeowner doesn't have to be present. So.
Yeah, I know, but you also have created a power of attorney for the homeowner in which the power that person is standing in the shoes of the homeowner, which could be interpreted he no longer has to be present. I want to make sure I pointed that out. Can I have another minute, because I have two more rules really quick, just like these.
All right.
We're again on rule 6, now part 2. The 30 days, we go up from 15 days to 30 days for the petition for review, but that's still really short. In reality, the banks are not getting back to my clients in 30 days with the mediation paperwork. And 15 days is certainly too short. 30 days is still too short. And I'm getting repeat mediations because the banks are not following through with what we agreed to in the mediation. Our choices were judicial review, but that ends in 15 days or 30, or we redo the mediation. I think that you should extend that to 60 days because of the nature of this beast. This is a slow-moving machine, these banks are. And to get the modification paperwork through their system takes more than that time in 30 days, and I would suggest a 45-day or 60-day extension. It doesn't hurt the banks, and it helps the homeowner, who still has the teeth of the mediation, saying, well, you agreed to this, you signed it, but you didn't produce the paperwork. And they come back to me in 45 days, go, I haven't gotten anything, what do we do? I have to tell them that the judicial process has been eliminated by statute of limitations, and we're stuck going back to mediation, in which I'm going to be doing two of those next week. Well, we're right back, we have an agreement, but they never performed.
Any questions, Jeff?
Well, Mr. Ravenholt, again, when we drafted this initially, the 15 days was trying to keep things moving because we don't want either side to deliberately delay things. The whole idea is to resolve these with alacrity. about every petition for judicial review, and I may miss one, but I think just about everyone in this state from any type of proceedings, a 30-day time period after the decision is made by its administrative body or whatever to request judicial review. So the fee proposal, which I think lenders have objected to, by the way, in their comments, by us increasing from 15 to 30 or suggesting that, but it was just to match it up so they're all consistent. You as a lawyer would know we're trying to create consistency there.
And I appreciate that, and you have covered yourself with regards to the mediation expiration date, because in that rule, it's 30 days after the expiration date, so it does extend technically when you have a mediation, a modification that was done. I'm just pointing out in the rule that that was an issue. And finally, this is something we should deal with, and it's the mediation rule 8, and we're dealing with the first paragraph over on page 8. You state that additional documents or estimates of the mediator that may later direct or may be required by a government program. This is a huge monster for a homeowner that's not represented because they have no idea what any of the government programs require. I, as an attorney, know those documents, including the 4506T document, the financials, and the profit and loss statements from small businesses. But for those unrepresented homeowners, this has put stops to mediations. When the bank says, you did not produce the documents we need for us to make a decision today, and therefore there's not going to be a mediation decision because you didn't bring the 4506T and have it signed to us. It's a help for the bank to not mediate. And so I think what you should do is address that if the bank wants extra documents other than those covered in the documents sent to homeowners, that they specifically request them in that 10-day package that we get 10 days prior to the mediation. And then there's no mystery that the homeowner, who's unrepresented, knows that the bank's going to need that two paychecks, not two paychecks from the time you filed for mediation, which is 60 days late. And the banks are always saying, no, those are too old, I want the two new paychecks. I want the ones from last month. And that's another issue that the banks have used. These are old paychecks, though they were the last two prior to filing for mediation. They're 60 days late by the time you get to mediation, and they require updated ones for their programs that they facilitate. So I think that you should put that burden on the bank if they want additional documents other than what's required in the package that's sent out, that they specifically request those and can't use the fact they're absent for reason to not mediate. That's just a personal experience I've had with the program, and I appreciate the time.
All right, thank you. Okay, anybody else out there? Yes. And, you know, that was very helpful the way he presented this. He went by rule, by rule, by rule. And that's what we're looking for.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. My name is Erin Elizabeth Light. I'm a brand new mediator. I've only observed one mediation. But I do know from my own practice, concerning Rule 8, when a previous woman spoke about the most expeditious way of getting documents to exchanging documents would be email or web, I have several clients that do not have access to computers, and especially clients that are in financial difficulty and are losing their homes. I had a client came in the other day. She didn't even know she had a notice of default, but I looked it up on the record because she doesn't have access to a computer. So I understand that we want it the most expeditious way, but I'm not sure that if we require email, that that would be the best for the homeowner. And that's my only comment.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yes.
Good afternoon. Lindsay Statlander. I'm with Nevada Home Relief Center. I'm actually an attorney here in town, but I have a separate company, licensed as a coverage service provider. I did submit something to the court regarding the issues that were just addressed. My proposal to try and rectify some of these problems with document production is to maybe have a pre-mediation, mandatory pre-mediation meeting. At that meeting, the parties could get together, the lenders could provide information to the homeowners as to what documentation is needed, then they could do, facilitate the exchange at that time, so at the time of the mediation, it becomes much more meaningful. As I said, there's like a 5-page proposal in there.
Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
Hi, my name's Colette Putnam. I'm a licensed private investigator. And as far as the web technology he's talking about, I can't tell you how many people come into my office trying to ask me to help them find the documentation they need because they don't have access to a computer, the knowledge to run a computer, or even to know what it is to do. Some of them are elderly, some of them are young. You can't confine it to web-based technology for most of the folks that I see. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. I'll make my comments brief. Dean Gould again, licensed attorney and mediator. I just wanted to make a few comments. Rule 5-4C on the trust issue. One unintended result of this could be that as a mediator, I'm now in a position where I have to look behind the trust to see if there is a trust, who the trustor is. I would suggest that when they elect mediation, if there is a trust, have them fill out a form that lays out the primary elements of the trust, who the settlor is, who the trustee is, that the trust is in full force of effect, and let them sign it under oath. That'll stop me from now having to look behind it. I envision there will be objections to that if I don't have that information. Number two, with regard to the power of attorney that was mentioned before, one of the caveats that I see in there, and I understand why it's there, is that they can't be compensated, because what you're trying to avoid, and I think appropriately, are people who are not otherwise allowed to come into the mediation to represent borrowers sneaking in, so to speak, through the use of powers of attorney. The problem is, again, as a mediator, I have no way to know that they've been compensated or not. I can ask the question, but I have to take them at face value. Again, I would ask that if someone is going to use a power of attorney, that they sign something under oath that they have received no compensation. It would just make my job easier and make the system a little more appropriate. Finally, I'm going to raise something that I'm surprised nobody else has raised, and that's Rule 16, with regard to the ability to reduce mediator's fee to something less than $400. I would submit to you, and I've written comments in, so I don't have to go into every detail, that's going to have a very negative effect. We are already spending countless hours on many, many mediations where we're getting a fee of $400. I think it should be clear that once the mediation has been assigned, that mediation fee is earned. We have no control over whether that mediation gets canceled. It could be canceled at the last minute. And we are often asked, and I do this a lot, during the pre-mediation period, I'm talking to parties, we often will try to settle it. Not personally, but there is a disincentive to settling it if all of a sudden now I get zero or something less than 400 versus having them come to my office. I would ask you not to approve that. Thank you.
You agree, though, that if a mediator disqualifies, they shouldn't get the fee?
I agree if they're disqualified.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Can you think of other instances in which the mediator's been named? The process is only in the early stages, and there shouldn't be any fee earned?
No, because with the disqualification, we are required under the rule to recuse ourselves within 2 days.
Why don't you say that?
We never have done any work, but if you sign that form and send it back immediately. If you don't, then we're not following the rule. Mm-hmm. I can't really think of any other situation. Are there instances where I have gone and found out that somebody has moved away, or they call me and say, I no longer want to do mediation, and even though I say to them, well, here's the benefit of doing the mediation, they say no. Yeah, that happens sometimes, but it's very minimal compared to the number of cases where I will spend upwards of 20 hours on a case and still just get the $400.
Mr. Gould, I tell you, in working on that rule, that's not the intention. If the mediator's done work, they get to get paid absent a disqualification or something like that. This is something, if let's say it's rescinded and the parties mutually consent to the rescission, and the mediator, you may have got an assignment, but you haven't done anything or so, something like that. That was the intent here.
Well, and I appreciate that, Your Honor. My response would be that there are a few cases where if I get an assignment on Wednesday, that case hasn't been assigned and the paperwork is now like Thursday or Friday.
Okay.
So it would be a very, very short window.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I suppose the other part of that is that the fee is rather low for the time spent on most mediations, so this is all to average itself out. There might be those mediations where it's a circumstance, and for that, the mediator benefits from the fee, but most of the cases are taking much longer than what was envisioned when the statute was adopted, so
I would agree.
It all kind of averages out, and you get the spoils, as few as they may be, with the burdens, as many as they may be.
Correct. And the other thing I would just point out to you is that the way that this rule is proposed, once the mediator is assigned, the $400 is non-refundable to the parties.
Right.
But yet, we could have our fee reduced. So where does that difference go?
I don't. Never mind.
No, that's rhetorical. That's rhetorical, Your Honor.
I was thinking about
you don't need to answer.
Making a joke, but those have a way of showing up someplace you don't want to be. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Jacob Hafter, attorney representing numerous homeowners. I think perhaps following up on that comment, the only other right scenario would be when a mediation's been stayed by the court. Perhaps there may be a situation where a fee may be questionable. But I ask today that you consider additional changes, and I will be submitting in writing a request to Rule 5, Subsection 8. There's discussion in that rule that the beneficiary has to present somebody at all times who has the authority to negotiate and modify the loan. I've, in my experience, never been at a mediation where the person on behalf of the beneficiary has true authority to negotiate or modify a loan. They have the authority to enter them or pre-qualify them into a program. They have the authority to check some boxes off. A lot of times, we don't even know who owns the loan. So how could they have authority as to really modify that loan? I think that that is a source of severe ambiguity that will probably be coming before this court in the future. But for future rulemaking, it would be nice to be able to get some kind of understanding that maybe we're not just talking about true modification of a loan, but some kind of fitting within a governmental program or a bank program or the like, if we're going to take the lender side, or say, no, you actually have the authority to modify the loan right then and there, not subject to underwriting, not subject to having to jump through 300 more hurdles. And I would request that the court in the next
revision.
That's
what the rule says.
I'm sorry?
I said that's what the rule and the statute say. So when you have a situation like this where someone shows up and they lack the authority, do you contest that? Have you pursued petitions for judicial review?
We contest that, Your Honor, and often the mediators don't feel like they have the capacity to determine true authority at that point. And also, I've been in situations where Judge Mosley has you know, asked, he said, well, what do we need to show evidence of authority? And it's become a situation which, like I said, without getting into specific cases, will probably be coming before the court shortly. Thank you.
Okay, anybody else?
Yep. Once again, Pat McKnight, I'm a licensed attorney and a mediator in the program. Specifically, Rule 16, as mediator, I'm not in favor of it. And I'd like to add just to the comments, our mediations typically go about 2 hours. At least that's my experience. One of the reasons they go so quickly, however, is the preparation that goes into getting them done before we ever get to the mediation date. So if you're going to adopt this rule, I'd like you to consider the amount of work it goes into setting them, and the fact that my schedule is set a month in advance. If I have to block out a 3 or 4 hour period for these mediations, and then it cancels within 2 weeks, it may look as though we didn't do any work, but now, you know, I've got a time slot now that's going to be very hard to fill. I'd like that to be considered. And the way the rule is worded now is that the administrator shall just establish a fee schedule. If we're going to leave this rule in some effect. I'd like to see some mechanism whereby we can at least submit our comments to the administrator as to the amount of work that goes into it. I'm fortunate. I have a very good assistant who sets these, and she works very hard. She goes through all of those documents that are submitted to make sure that they are correct, so we don't show up at mediation and find out, oh, this document was more than 60 days old. These bank statements are too old, and that's one reason that we're so successful in getting them done. But I don't know that. And probably I don't give her enough credit, but I want to make sure that this court does, that there's a lot of staff work that goes into it. And I know there's a lot of mediators who don't have that type of staff support. They're doing it on their own, and I'd like to just make sure that doesn't get lost in this room. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have all organized. I promise 1 minute.
No, we gave you your time. Got a few more folks who want to present. Yes, ma'am.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Denise Meikert. I'm a Nevada licensed attorney and a mediator. I've been a mediator since the very beginning. I don't know what the intent is. My comment has to do actually with rural time, which no one has touched yet when it comes to the temporary agreements. Again, it's called the temporary agreement, but subpart two has to do with any agreement to relinquish the home. First of all, under a temporary agreement, usually the way that those have been contemplated is some sort of to give a homeowner more time possibly to qualify for a loan, or again under the trial periods under a modification to see whether or not that they further qualify for a permanent modification or forbearance to get them back on track. So I've not ever seen anything where a temporary modification has anything to do with relinquishing property. The more important issue is that any temporary agreement where, as part of the agreement, people are going to vacate their home. Again, I don't know what the intent behind this is, but the way that it works right now is that if, say, a particular period passes and a homeowner does not comply, at least in my mediator statements, and say they're supposed to do something with a certain period of time, and that the homeowner doesn't do it or doesn't qualify, then the trustee can go ahead and apply for the trustee certificate and foreclose. But because when you're in mediation and still there has been no foreclosure yet, it's impossible to know what a vacate date would be when you're in a mediation. And until a foreclosure occurs, you can't very well get a homeowner to agree to move out of their home. So I don't see where there's any circumstance where agreement to relinquish property could also have a specific vacate date.
All right. Thank you. Okay.
To that comment real quick, that rule change.
Is it pertaining to Rule 10?
Precisely. Again, Mike and Brooks on behalf of Brooks Tower.
Just to follow up on what she's saying, there's additional language in here that says, upon the administrator's confirmation of the trustee's compliance with the vacate date in the agreement. It's not clear what exactly that means, because theoretically there would be no trustee requirement with regard to the vacate date. We're talking about a date which the borrower leaves. Pre-foreclosure, obviously, otherwise you wouldn't be able to get your certificate, which is a great point that was brought up. The language can be clarified to confirmation of the compliance with the vacate agreement. And I would propose that the vacate date could be a date in the future post-foreclosure, a specified time after foreclosure is completed, but a sort of certificate would be allowed to be entered prior to the foreclosure. And that's beneficial for both the bank and the borrower if the certificate is issued while the homeowner remains in the premises subject to this, so that the property is maintained, which is obviously a larger issue for the community. The only other point I want to piggyback on is something that Mr. Gould brought up about the trusts. And I understand that there's a desire to clarify the treatment of trust, but there's no indication to suggest who an owner-occupier is under that rule provision. In other words, if it's the settlor of the trust or the beneficiary of the trust that's the occupier of the premises, it seems to suggest that every property held in trust would be an eligible eligible participant, regardless of whether the trust beneficiary or the settler is the occupier of the premises. And I don't think that was the intention of the statute. It could be an investment property held in trust, I think, the way the rule is written. That's all I have.
Mr. Brooks, I was wondering, could you send us maybe some suggested language on those points?
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else out there?
Carson.
Okay, hearing none, we're going to move to Carson City. And I've got a list here. And again, in Carson City, I'll again ask you to keep your comments relevant to the proposed amendments to the rules. And the first one I have listed is Grand Lease. I'm sorry, I can't hear. Tracy, is there any?
His attorney has decided he'd prefer to wait a few minutes to make his comments, and he may choose not to make comments after all. Given the court's request that comments be limited in certain manner, in a certain way. I'm Philip A. Olson. I'm Mr. Wise's attorney.
Okay. And do you have comments related to these proposed amendments?
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I come before the court this afternoon to speak in opposition to proposed rule 2.3c, which would expand controls over mediators by the mediation administrator. Your Honor, I must say I am of the opinion, I disagree strongly with Ms. Campbell, I believe that this program is a failure. I believe that this program has failed because the mediation administrator has already assumed too much control over the mediation process and has done so for the benefit of the lending industry. Specifically, the mediation administrator forbids mediators from performing their law-imposed duties, including the duty under Section 5 of the foreclosure mediation law that a mediator shall prepare and submit to the mediation administrator a petition and recommendation concerning the imposition of sanctions against the beneficiary in certain situations. Program requirements that go beyond the rules adopted by this court prohibit mediators from recommending sanctions against lenders. The situation we have here is one where the legislature has created a remedy for the benefit of Nevada homeowners designed to keep them in their homes, under which the district court is empowered to impose sanctions against lenders to meet their statutory obligations under this statute. However, the mediation administrator prohibits mediators from filing these petitions, which are the key steps that would lead to the imposition of sanctions against lenders. In creating these requirements, the mediation administrator is acting on the advice of outside counsel, which happens to be a law firm that boasts a 125-year attorney-client relationship with Wells Fargo Bank. Your Honor,
you're running out of time.
Pardon me?
You're running out of time here. Did you also, I believe you submitted written comments as well, didn't you?
I did.
Okay. If you want to sum it up, I'll give you a minute.
Thank you. Your Honor, in prohibiting mediators from complying with the law, the mediation administrator purports to act with the authority of this court. Adopting Rule 2.3c would be an approval by this court of the mediation administrator's control for the lending industry over this program. I urge that the rule be rejected. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. All right, I've got an indication that Seth Adams wishes to speak.
Uh,
afternoon, Your Honor. Seth Adams on behalf of McCarthy Holthus. We do represent primarily lenders during the foreclosure mediation. Just some very small procedural concerns, primarily with Rule 5, Subsection 7, the rescission of Panel D. With respect to obtaining written parties, there are obviously wire notices. I think there may even, in one instance I had, the NOD was rescinded because it had in fact been cured, in essence requiring a signed agreement by all parties. Obviously, to resolve the mediation would be a little excessive. Obviously, preserving, I think, some of the arguments for the court with respect to the NOD being used be a way of drafting Rule 5, Subsection 7, to permit, I guess, continuing jurisdiction for a petition if that were the case. Moving on to Rule 6, Subsection 2, the language is actually that the proposed amendment is seeking to change to start the timeline for to file a petition. It does, in fact, remain at 15 days or move on to 30. I do think that there needs to be some certainty as to whether received means, you know, some mediators do provide a copy of the mediation agreement at the time of the petition. Others, in fact, choose to mail that within their 10-day right to do so. So I believe leaving the language as it is to received is more appropriate. Lastly, Rule 8. There has been certainly much ado in the media with respect to document production by both sides to the mediation. The interrelationship between Rule 8 and Rule 5, I do believe that some of Rule 8 to address that, although I do believe that there's a way to draft the rule in such a way where all parties are very certain as to what document to refer to have the addresses of the parties to whom they need to exchange those documents and what documents specifically need to be exchanged. As has been evidenced by several other speakers, the documents the mediator may later direct as well as may be required by a government program. I do believe that Rule 8 would be well served by having some sort of means of addressing when, if there are to be any additional requirements, when either party can be notified of what those additional requirements are. The concern obviously lying with if we're waiting until 10 days prior to the mediation to find out from a mediator that they will be requiring of my clients two additional documents, it may be too late to produce those. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, next I've got on this list Ernie Nelson. Are you there, Mr. Nelson? Nielsen.
My name is Ernie Nielsen with the Washoe County Senior Law Project. We're a legal service organization, and we are also a HUD-certified housing counseling agency and therefore have housing counselors that often appear at mediations. We do appreciate that you've expanded the time for judicial review. That's, I think, a very helpful change in the rules. With respect to Rule 10, I think that the language got includes forbearance agreements, although forbearance agreements don't technically modify terms of the agreement. But I'm also a little concerned about the fact that sometimes we enter into what we would consider permanent agreements, which take place after a certain point in time, and I certainly wouldn't want this rule to prohibit that type of a transaction agreement at mediation. After Rule 5, Section 7, I totally agree with the rule because the object of this program is to agreement between the I would agree with a previous speaker with respect to Rule 8, with respect to the government programs. I think that there's some documents related to government lender or mediator requests from the homeowner that they can specifically answer for them. Only in the issue of the most expeditious way. I think a lot of our clients, if they weren't represented by us, would not be able to communicate by email. And then finally, with respect to the proposed rules, Rule 16, with respect to the recommendation for mediation as faith, we have clients who sometimes are not able to pay that $200. So I wonder if there's an accommodation that from homeowners are having to pay the $200 a second time around. Thank you. Comments that I will submit in writing with respect to proposed changes I would suggest on other aspects of this rule. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Nielsen. All right, the next one I have on the list is Teresa McKee.
My name is Teresa McKee. I'm counsel for the Nevada Association of Realtors. The Nevada Association of Realtors serves as the official voice of realtors in the state of Nevada. I have submitted written comments from here. I don't think you have them yet, so I won't be taking much time. We generally support this program and the amendments thereto, and that's all I wanted to say is that we do support these amendments. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, next one I've got is C.J. Morrison. All right, Ms. Morrison, do you have some comments on the proposed amendments?
I do. And my name is C.J. Morgan. I'm a homeowner. I have gone through the foreclosure mediation program once. And found out on Friday that the bank had rescinded the notice of default, and I was very surprised to find out that I now get to go through this program a second time. And so I'm here because I only just found out this weekend that the public hearing was available. I apologize. I don't have the rule number, but I would like to comment on the proposed rule change. Proposed rule change to modify the rules on the exchange of documents. And I have a few other comments that I would also like to submit in writing to the court. But first of all, regarding the change on the exchange of rule documents, when I went through the first mediation, the foreclosure was denied because the lender did not bring the right documents to the mediation. And from the documents they submitted to me on Friday, it looks to me like they're doing the same thing they did last time. So I would like to request that the court look at what is going on. One of the justices mentioned it earlier, that there are a lot of things going on with the robo-signers, with the documents that are showing that the lenders foreclosing are not the lenders who are supposed to be foreclosing because they have no legal holding. They aren't the holder of the note. This is opening up homeowners like me to double liability because if I agree to a loan modification with the current lender that claims that they can foreclose on my home, later on the true holder of the note might come forward and I will also owe them money as well. So I'm asking the court to look at this more closely and put something into the rules that states that if they don't have the legal right to do this, they cannot keep taking me back through rescission of notice of default and then submitting another notice of default when they aren't the legal holders and have no legal right to foreclose. I think a lot of homeowners are getting forced into short sales and loan modifications with the wrong people and for the wrong reasons. So I'm asking that the court consider more protections for the homeowners.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Morgan. All right. Next on the list, I've got Liz Gonzalez.
But I do have a few things I would like to address. I'm Liz Gonzalez. I am a mediator in the program.
The one thing I would like to mention is the documents to be provided to the mediator at the time of the mediation, which would include the certified copies of the note, the deed of trust, and the assignments. They are typically emailed with a statement that is, I guess, expression of what is addressed in, I believe, item 8 of Rule 5, which is that the certified copies are only satisfied if they provide that note statement. The problem is that is being emailed to us typically and not brought to mediation with the certifications. And another point I'd like to make is those documents might be certified individually since they are not being attached properly for certification. And that seems to be kind of a chronic concern. So we might address that. And then the other thing I would like to mention is the authority of the representative of the beneficiary in writing. You're not getting that. You know, they're just there, and we're not necessarily getting anything that's documenting that they are the, you know, the person of authority. So those are the two.
Well, I'm not. I'd like to ask you a question about both those issues. You're the mediator. You are, if you receive documents that you're not satisfied are authentic, then what action do you take? Don't you reject the presentment?
The way we are instructed is to, if both parties would like to carry through with the mediation, that we can do that, but that I do need to address that on the statement, which I do. What is there, what is not there.
And if someone is sitting there and you're not satisfied that they possess the necessary authority to modify the loan, what do you do then? Can't you just determine that that's not a satisfactory compliance and advise the mediator, the administrator of that fact?
Well, the I guess what I'm saying is that the person of authority appears and without some sort of a I'm saying that the program could possibly use some sort of a document that says, you know, this person is authorized to modify and negotiate the loan. And sometimes we do get that every once in a while. But that this person is authorized to modify and negotiate the loan on behalf of, you know, the foreclosing party.
Well, someone brought this up earlier here in Las Vegas, and I guess I'm a little surprised by this. If you're a mediator and you're not satisfied that the person sitting there has the authority to mediate, why don't you simply report that and end the process?
We can, but if both parties, here's the thing, as a mediator, we can mediate if both parties would like to mediate. Now, if we're not satisfied, but they're saying they are, and the homeowner has paid their money and would like to mediate, I'm just saying to alleviate that problem, what you might address is something formal to demonstrate that that person has the authority versus us making that determination at the mediation with nothing in, you know, that's required.
Are we seeing a lot of issues then where people are showing up that don't have authority, that are representing that they do have authority, and we're finding out later that that's not the case? Is that what's happening?
We find out later that's not the case because we don't normally know the outcome of the mediation. What I am saying is that if, for instance, somebody can show up representing a beneficiary, but do they you know, have authority to negotiate and modify? I think we should have that in writing because how, you know, if they are a representative of a beneficiary, but do they truly have that authority?
Form notwithstanding, isn't it still, doesn't the rule still require the mediator to make that call? I mean, I guess that's my confusion.
Well, the rule says someone with authority shall appear.
So if there's some question about it, then I think perhaps maybe the mediation shouldn't proceed, and I believe that remains the obligation of the mediator to control that.
I think there could also be a question about it if you don't have, if that's not documented. That's what I'm saying. If it's not documented, what do, you know, who's saying that they do? Who's saying that they don't? I'm saying we should have something that's documenting it, saying that they do. If they're saying they do, you know, who's giving them that authority? That a verbal authority? Oh, yeah, the beneficiary gave me this authority verbally. I'm just saying it would, as a mediator, and to alleviate any concerns, it would be beneficial, I believe, to have something documented on that.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Justice Evans, are you seeing anything with your meetings that that's an issue where they're showing up indicating they have authority and then not having authority?
I haven't seen it or heard about it. I mean, it's just, that's why we have the public hearing, to find out that type of information. So anyway, I think we'll need to talk about it.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, I'd like...
I will put some things in writing, because there is, I mean, there are some more details to that I could address, and I would be happy to do that.
Well, I'd like to find out from, I'd like to have the program administrator, maybe not today, but at some point, provide us some comment on that concerning the education of mediators. I'm just surprised that a mediator wouldn't insist... to their satisfaction, whatever that entails, that the person who's sitting there has the authority to speak for the party that they claim to have authority for. And if the mediator isn't satisfied, then that provision of the statute doesn't seem to me to have been met. And we can request all the writings in the world, but at the end of the day, the mediator must make an independent assessment as to whether or not the person sitting there has authority. And if they don't, then why waste everyone's time? They didn't comply with the statute. Case, I don't understand it. Why are we making this so much more difficult than it needs to be? I mean, if the parties insist that you proceed with mediation, it seems to me there's a potential disservice if the person sitting there lacks authority. Your time's been wasted, the homeowner's time's been wasted, and whoever this rogue representative's time has been wasted. I just don't understand this. This is perplexing to me. I'll look forward to your written submissions. Well, I really will.
I'm curious as to how many rogues we have out there. That's, I just have no read on it.
I think we may have a comment from Legal Aid from here, from
yes.
Southern Nevada.
If I may, again, my name is Venetia Considine. I'm an attorney with the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. This situation that we see echoing the lady in Carson City is that we have somebody, again, I know this was talked about the last time, who comes in, who represents the beneficiary, opens up their cell phone, and makes a phone call to the lender, and the lender is a loan specialist lead or some title like that. They then run the numbers through right there. At that point, there is a discussion about, do you have the authority? And there usually an argument about whose opinion of authority. I have the authority to offer you this. Well, if that doesn't include modifying the loan or negotiating something outside of what stringent areas you've just given, I don't feel that that is authority. The other side argues that is authority. That leaves it up to the mediator. And I don't...
Who has the authority to say, get out of my office?
I have yet to see that happen, though, Your Honor. I think...
Well, then we need to address the education of our mediators. This is very perplexing.
I think if the mediators had a specific rule that they could point to and could feel comfortable doing
that... They've got the rule.
It's in the rule.
It's there. They just have to enforce it, so...
I just want to let you know it does happen all the time.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Next on my list in Carson City, Dave Campbell.
Dave Campbell, City. And just a quickie on the documentation. I wish we could get a solution to MERS. Who is the beneficiary? Who has the assignments? When you try to check the records that the lender brings in, it really is a mess. It's almost impossible to track it through. I have the authority to say, no, you did not present all of the assignments. Cut it off right there. But that certainly does not support the objectives of the program. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay, that's all I've got on my list in Carson City. Is there anybody else who would like to speak specifically to the proposed amendments as they're contained in Exhibit A?
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Grant Wise, and I'm a property owner. I am involved in trying to negotiate a loan modification, and I won't go into that. But I do have some comments to make based on what I've been finding as I'm going through this process. excuse me a minute. I'll put my glasses on. Okay. These are comments as a citizen, and I think this affects many of the people who are trying to get some modifications through this program. The current program restricts a citizen from recording these proceedings. In other words, we've got nothing to back up what happens at these proceedings, so that if it has to go beyond that, for instance, to court or something else, we're at the mercy of he said, she said. The lender keeps changing the game all the time and has tremendous resources to use against us as individual owners. They have financial resources we don't begin to be able to have to help us on our side. We're at a big disadvantage when we walk into the mediation from that standpoint. Okay. I'm concerned that the law is not being followed according to its intent, the legislative intent. I believe the legislature implemented this program to keep people in their homes. Nevada has taken a major step in this direction to help level the playing field by implementing this program. Therefore, regarding any changes to the program, and even the current program as it exists, I think some things need to be looked into there and as to how this program is being administered. It's very important for the court to use its resources to uphold the law and advocate for the citizens of Nevada. Do not create a situation which could cause further hardship, and not adopt any policies which make it more difficult than it currently already is for the individual homeowner. And that's
all right. Thank you, Mr. Weiss. We appreciate your comments. Anybody else in Carson City?
Very briefly on Rule 8.1, the rule that says or documents required by a government entity. I would ask that you have somebody in advance, because otherwise we won't know. Neither will the homeowner, of course. I'd like to also just address this issue of authority. The way this has come up, and I've had this in my last three mediations, is the bank walks in and they ask for a document for the first time at the mediation, which is not a document the debtor is required to produce. Declaration of insurance in the last two of them. And I usually send people home to go pick it up. But what the bank then says is they have no authority to make any offer until they see this one document, which they only just asked for when they walked in the door. So that's how the authority problem usually arises. Thank you.
Well, let me ask you a question, if you would indulge me. You're saying they're asking for documents that aren't required by the rule, and you have to halt your mediation, send them to get these documents. Why are you doing that if the rule doesn't require that they produce these documents?
Because they're taking exception, they either accept or make any offer until they see this one document.
I'm not going to go there, but you've got your rules. You can enforce your rules, and there's a very specific structure there for you to follow. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, sir, would you state your name, please?
Mark Walter, attorney here. I've been doing a lot of mediations, over 250 of them, and one of the, I think, deficiencies in the current rules is, I think the theme that runs through the rules and runs through the mortgage statutes is full disclosure. One of the items from the facts which needs to be disclosed at mediation by the lender is the amount paid for the deficiency. RS 40.451 appears to say, there's no case law on it, but it appears to hold that the amount of a deficiency, it incorporates 40.455, is limited to what the lien holder paid. At mediation, the lenders routinely, when the subject of deed in lieu, and a deed in lieu of foreclosure is favored under the law, when that subject comes up, they invariably refuse to agree to a deed in lieu and waive the deficiency. The borrower, in order to make an intelligent decision, needs to know how big the deficiency bear is and if, in fact, that bear actually exists. I've seen the testimony taken by a very fine lawyer, Nick Wooten, out of Alabama, of officers of MERS, and most of these are MERS deeds of trust. And the MERS officers admit when those MERS assignments are made, no consideration is paid to MERS. And MERS is a bogus operation. But so in order, when they want to foreclose, they have to issue these assignments for which no consideration is paid. It would be, if 40.451 means what it says, that therefore there can be no deficiency judgment under the MERS deed of trust. And that's something that borrowers desperately need to know because it directly affects their decision whether to reaffirm a debt, which is upside down. That's all I have, Your Honor.
Thank you.
J. Morgan.
I believe, didn't we just give you a chance to speak?
Say something following up what two of the other people who followed me.
All right. Sure. All right.
For the gentleman who just preceded me, I have to agree with him. My understanding is that this is a deed of trust date, and such that because it is such, the note is a non-negotiable instrument. It's governed by Article 3 of the Uniform Commercial Code, and it's not governed by the real estate laws of the state. And my understanding is that what that means is when the real estate laws say somebody records a mortgage, the deed of trust is recorded. That doesn't give anyone the right to collect a debt. The deed of trust is a security or... So by setting up every deed of trust with MERS, as many of the mortgages are in this state, MERS is the nominee of the beneficiary. And they've created a system, the lenders have created a system that hides the identity of the holder of the note, which means that that is the person, that is not the person who can foreclose on the note. That said, I have more, which I will submit to you in writing, but one of the other people...
Yes, and you're getting a little off the subject here. Again, we're speaking very specifically about the proposed amendments to the rule that are contained in Exhibit A, and... So we're getting off course here.
I understand, Your Honor. I just hope that the justices will also consider other factors that need to go into this law, this rule, to protect the homeowners, because a lot of people are getting foreclosed on illegally.
All right. Thank you.
But my second point is the training of the mediators. My experience with the mediator was that the mediator knew nothing and did the same thing. My attorney had to point out to the mediator that they hadn't brought the right documents. The mediator would not make that call until my attorney forced the issue. So the mediators need more training in this process. And thank the court for hearing me.
Thank you. Okay, anybody else in Carson City? Okay, I do not see anybody else in Carson City, and everybody in Las Vegas was given ample opportunity. What I'm going to ask is that any of you that have additional comments that you would like us to consider, please feel free to submit that to us within the comment period, which will extend through Friday, December 10th. Colleagues, do you have any other comments, any questions, anything else you want to delve into at this point? Justice Gibbons?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
All right, then we thank you all very much for your attendance here today, and for the things that you've shared with us today, and this matter will stand submitted in the court.